Hello and welcome to Meandering with Myrn, a potpourri podcast by me, veterinary ethologist Myrn Milani. Join me as I ponder any and all things animal and human, what we know and what we don't, where we've been, where we are, and where we're headed.
During the early part of my veterinary career, a few far-thinking folks realized the combined meetings for veterinarians, pediatricians, and family practitioners on subjects of mutual interest would benefit members of these professions and their patients. Although those who attended considered this a wonderful idea, it was too far ahead of its time. The problem-oriented method and the rise of specialists with their attendant silo thinking didn't embrace such cooperation and sharing of ideas. But one of the few meetings that snuck under the conventional radar back then addressed the parallels and connections between children's and animal welfare. The opening speaker began his talk with some history. He noted that the primary concern of Henry Berg, the founder of the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, was the mistreatment of horses routinely used for transport and hauling in the mid to late 1800s. But more relevant to the seminar and this podcast, Berg also used those same organizational skills to help found the Massachusetts Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children. He did this several years later because the two causes were so similar. The timing of these two organizations' creation stuck in my mind because it reaffirmed something my dad told me about society's view of children back then. He knew of this firsthand as an orphan in the early years of the 20th century. Although there were some good people out there, society in general viewed orphans on a par with animals. If and what kind of care they received depended on their breeding and behavior. As a group, they were viewed as chattel, with whom adults could do as they chose. But what does a transport of an estimated 250,000 children between 1854 and 1929 have to do with contemporary mass dog transport? When I watched the American Experience Orphan Train segment on PBS and then read more about the history of the trains, I was struck by how similar the thinking that supported its creation and function parallels what's going on in the transport of unwanted dogs from areas with large populations to other locations. But whereas the orphans were shipped out in actual trains, transported dogs often move through an informal network more akin to an underground railroad. As far as motivation goes, consider this description of Charles Loring Brace's vision when he and a group of businessmen came up with the idea of shipping New York City's orphans to places in the country via trains. Quote, "Railroads were the most inexpensive way to move children westward from poverty-filled homes, orphanages, poorhouses, and off the streets. In the West and Midwest, Brace believed, solid, God-fearing homes could be found for the children. Food would be plentiful with pure air to breathe, and a good work ethic developed by living on a farm would help them grow into mature, responsible adults, able to care for themselves." Unquote. As companion dogs increasingly became the norm in post-World War II industrialized American society, finding problem dogs a nice home in the country became, and sometimes still remains, a stock solution. Both orphan children and unowned dog transport systems suffered from many of the same problems. At the highest level, their goal was to get rid of perceived troublesome populations as fast and as inexpensively as possible. The focus was on the numbers. The more kids or dogs transported out of the area, the more successful the project. Or so the thinking went at that level. This isn't to say that the organizers of the relocations didn't care about the welfare of the transported individuals, but those in charge often cared about the numbers more. How well any specific transported individual fared was left to those working at the lowest levels. And the amount of knowledge, skill, and time to devote to their charges of those on that level could vary considerably. Some of those people were better at doing their jobs than others. Lack of reliable documentation and oversight regarding what individual children or dogs experienced prior to and as they made their way through the system and after placement was common. Reports of successful placements became part of the sponsoring organization's public relations programs to generate more funding. However, neither form of transport provided an all-positive experience. The lack of time, skilled workforce, and quality record-keeping could lead to mismatches or worse. Sometimes this resulted in injury to the adoptee or the adopter. Other times, children or dogs ran away. Whether adopters looked for the runaway depended on the quality of the bond between them. If it was such that the runaway wasn't considered worth the effort, the adopters wouldn't look, and the children or dogs would need to fend for themselves in an alien environment. Some would succeed, but others would not. And some of the latter would die. In both systems, the enthusiasm and support for placing the unowned children or dogs could be much greater than that for taking back one who didn't work out for some reason. In human and canine cases, individuals intimately associated with the process on the lowest levels were more likely to bear the emotional burdens of this than those at the source of the unwanted populations. In both systems, the effect of a problem was treated instead of its cause. Rather than addressing the poverty and lack of access to education and healthcare that created these excess populations, those who founded the programs opted to transport the resultant orphaned children and unowned dogs instead. What does the end of the orphan train era tell us about the future of canine transports? States passed laws to regulate the numbers and quality of the children they accepted from other states. Some of these laws also included addressing those circumstances that did or could contribute to similar populations of orphan children in their own states. Once this occurred and in-state regulated foster programs were created, the demand for the orphan trained children dried up. At this stage, it's impossible to say what will happen to the canine transport movement. I'd like to think that it will gradually fade as local control of canine populations increases and areas with established spay and neuter protocols consider their approaches more thoughtfully. Had we not campaigned for universal spay and neuter so vigorously in some areas, those areas wouldn't have decimated their local populations of companion dogs. Had we not created a void for those transporters to fill, those in areas with canine overpopulation would have had to address their canine problems sooner. That's the best case scenario, and it will take time and commitment to consider all the human and canine factors that contribute to this problem nationwide. It's not great, but it certainly beats the worst. A hot virus or parasite transmissible to people or the mauling of some high-profile politician's or celebrity's child by a transport dog who came with a sad, sad story, but no reliable history. Such an incident would result in a media feeding frenzy, mega blame placing, and reactive instead of mindful policies that would benefit dogs and humans alike. And so the cycle would begin again.
You've been listening to a podcast by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, and books about animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavior and bond sites, check out my website at www.mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the content of these podcasts are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music, Molly on the Shore by Percy Granger, is used with permission from Katova Arts, www.katova.com.